Today on Straight Talk Africa, the role of opposition political parties in Africa. Is there adequate space for them to operate? What would it take for them to be more effective in playing their role of checks and balance? That discussion is coming up next, right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing the role of opposition political parties in Africa. Many political observers describe the role of the opposition in Africa as an indispensable component of democracy. But for much of the continent, the opposition's role has not been inviolable. My colleague Esther Githui Ewart has our report.
For decades, opposition leaders and their supporters in Africa have been in constant confrontation and enduring running battles with ruling parties and incumbent governments, until he was succeeded by Emmerson Mnangagwa in November 2017. Robert Mugabe was the only leader Zimbabwe had known since independence from Britain in 1980. 4 decades after independence, Mugabe was accused of using death squads and rigging elections while crushing the opposition led by the late Morgan Tsvangirai. But after Mugabe's ouster through a de facto military coup, his former deputy turned rival and current president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, continues to stonewall the opposition through the strong arm tactics of its security forces. Ahead of the budget speech on November 22nd, Zimbabwe's police and parliament security ejected opposition legislators from parliament after they refused to stand up in honor of President Mnangagwa as he entered parliament. In Cameroon, where violence connected to a separatist movement in the nation's Anglophone region has forced tens of thousands to flee, 85-year-old President Paul Biya won re-election to a seventh term in a landslide victory in October. But his victory came amid claims from opposition candidates that the election was marred by fraud, ballot stuffing, and voter intimidation. In what appears to be the norm after elections in parts of Africa, opposition leader Maurice Kamto claimed victory at a news conference in Yaounde and called on Biya to hand over power peacefully, but did not offer any evidence to support his win. In 2017, longtime Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga went to the Supreme Court to seek the nullification of President Uhuru Kenyatta's election victory. A Kenyan court granted his request. But Odinga, however, pulled out of the repeat election and later declared himself the people's president at a ceremony in Nairobi. Protests and chaos erupted in various parts of the country, and the government, using police and other security personnel, engaged the protesters in violent street battles, using tear gas, wounding, and even shooting anyone who stood in their way. In South Africa, besieged former president Jacob Zuma faced a no-confidence vote in parliament, with the opposition describing him as a broken and corrupt leader. And as lawmakers prepared to vote in a secret ballot to oust him from office after years of scandals, opposition firebrand Julius Malema of the Economic Freedom Fighters took to the floor to address parliament. A minute later, his mic was switched off. But his supporters continued to protest on the streets, demanding Zuma's ouster. Eventually, Zuma stepped down. While visiting Ethiopia last month, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Tibor Nagy appealed to ruling parties in Africa to consider opposition parties as competitors rather than enemies. Nagy praised the example being set by Ethiopian Premier Abiy Ahmed as a model for other African countries. In Uganda, opposition leader Kizza Besigye, a former personal physician to President Yoweri Museveni, has endured years of police brutality. The government has often employed security officials to either keep him under house arrest or physically abuse him. Here, Besigye, whose hand is in a sling, is seen kicking police officers who are shoving him into a vehicle.
With hammers.
And he's not done yet.
What sort of police is this? working with Hamas.
As the Democratic Republic of Congo heads to the polls on December 23rd to replace another longtime president, Joseph Kabila, there are many opposition candidates running against Kabila's appointed successor and presidential candidate, Ramazan Shadary. Some 21 candidates are vying for the top seat. Several of the opposition candidates say they will support Martin Fayulu, others Felix Tshisekedi, while some in the opposition say they will support Shadary. Many of the rest say they would rather go at it alone, raising the question, are they really in opposition to the ruling party? Esther Githui Ewart, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Esther, for that interesting report. And joining us here in our Washington studio is Dr. James Ngundi, a political analyst and adjunct professor of languages in the African Studies program at Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C. Yeherwak Gashau, Pan-Africanist activist and actress. She joins us live via Skype from Dallas, Texas. And last but not least, Milton Alimadi, founder, publisher, and editor, Blackstar Newsletter. He joins us from the VOA Bureau in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for
it's
having
a pleasure.
Us.
You're most welcome.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome, Yeherwak. Let me come to you immediately. When you look at African politics, there are some people who say sometimes it looks like a civil war, especially when the heads of the opposition members try to step up to the plate to do their thing. Why is that so? James?
Thank you, Shaka, and thank you for having me on your show. I think the biggest challenge that we continue to face on the African continent as far as opposition politics is concerned is that politics in Africa still remains a zero-sum game. So it's really winner-take-all administratively, in terms of appointments, in terms of dishing out resources. And so it's a question of grabbing power and retaining power and the resources that the country has. And so leadership, we are yet to get to a point where leadership is about the people. Rather, what we have is leadership for the leaders or those who are occupying positions of leadership. And as long as that remains the case, I think we are going to have scenarios where those who are in the ruling power, those who are in power or those who are in the ruling party want to control everything and to keep everyone else out in the cold. Because gaining power or even sharing some of the power through equal, opportunities for opposition parties really means sharing resources. And most people in positions of leadership on the continent are not willing to share resources. It's all about resources. It's all about wealth and personal wealth rather than wealth of the citizens.
Are you talking about what some author has actually characterized as the politics of the belly, of the stomach?
Absolutely. It's all about the belly. It's all about what you can accumulate for yourself. And I think as long as that remains the case. Now, if we want to change politics, I think we'll have to look for ways to involve the masses and to change the mindset of the voters in terms of what really does opposition politics mean.
Yeherwak, let me come to you. Do you agree with James that we are actually looking at the politics of the belly, the politics of the stomach, and not politicians or leaders who are supposed to provide service to their people?
Yes, I agree. Because as the founder and president of the Ethiopian National Government in Exile, I have been, you know, fighting the same political culture, just my brother, expressed. And that's the problem. It's in Africa. First of all, there's no political parties. Instead of political parties, we become human rights and civil rights activists in order to build the political parties culture and principle in Africa. And so most of us are not free at all. That's why we are to leave the country. We have to flee the country, you know, and establish also political parties in diaspora.
What about in your country, Ethiopia? It looks like Ethiopia is undergoing fundamental change, really. Uh-huh. What about Ethiopia?
Yes, from the outsider's view, you know, it seems like that. Uh-huh. But let me give you an evidence of that oppressor government still, you know, in Ethiopia, despite their prime minister. Political parties in the diaspora were told to go back to Ethiopia and to practice freely, you know, their political parties, and to enlighten the people and to organize themselves for 2019 elections. And so a lot of people, a lot of political parties moved back to Ethiopia about 2-3 years ago. I mean, 2-3 months ago. They trust what Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed told them. And so they left the United States and Europe and Africa, wherever they live. And at the end, on November 27, they were told at a conference that they can't run for office because of dual citizens. And therefore, he suggests them to become advisor for election without political parties, you know? So the main political party is the TPLF-made political party, which is EPRDF, known as EPRDF. And so EPRDF will run in 2019, and other people that you even interview, they will not run. So now my question is, so where is the fundamental change, you know? And then they are told also to become 2 or 3 political parties, to condense, you know, like 20, 30, 40 political parties. And this political party leaders are known, you know, for not coming together. And so yet the prime minister advised them to become 2 or 3 political parties. Otherwise, he has no time, you know, to communicate with everybody or to focus on all the political parties. So in short, there's no fundamental political party, political change in Ethiopia. And also the constitution, according to Abiy, the 2000 election will be based on the APRDF constitution, which we have been fighting for the last 27 years. So this is the reality in Ethiopia, you know, but the outside government and the international media, you know, is publicizing as if there's a fundamental change in Ethiopia. And that's not true. That's not true.
Now, talk to me, Yaharawak. The last time I checked, you have not actually been to Ethiopia since the new dispensation came into being behind Abiy Ahmed. Yet, most of the people that I have met who have actually been in Ethiopia talk about a lot of good things are happening on the ground.
Yeah, listen, in fact, I support at the beginning, I support Abiy Ahmed. And in fact, I gave him credit for what he accomplished to this point. You know, when it comes to prisoners, when it comes to the freedom of press, when it comes to allow people just freely to go back to Ethiopia, I mean, start their political party there peacefully. And then, in fact, if you remember, I introduced U.S. government inclusive all-party conference in order to create people's constitution. And then that was introduced to Abiy also. So I have been working, you know, like with the U.S. government, I mean, embassy, and then the Ethiopian embassy, and then directly, you know, with Abiy. But my proposal to abolish the ethnic federalism and then president within a president and government within government and a country within nine country within a country, you know, all this is supposed really to change as soon as our understanding was as soon as the oppositional groups support him. And then I have been supporting, but at the same time, you know, I'm telling you, there's no fundamental change. It's just pseudo publicity. And then the people that support him, you know, 100%, they're not, you know, human rights or civil rights or political activists. You know, and they have been, some of them have been banned from entering to Ethiopia. So they went to Ethiopia after 50 years, after 40 years, after 27 years. Then, you know, with that excitement happiness, you know, what they see is their comfort and reuniting with their family after many years, but they don't see it like me, I mean, you know, or others. There are many oppositional parties that didn't go back to Ethiopia. And
but why don't you go and see for yourself rather than talking from Washington? Because you risk, in fact, being called someone who is suffering from political sour grapping.
Oh no, I'm planning to go to Ethiopia. I'm planning also to even change the name of the Ethiopian national government in exile, you know, to probably Ethiopian Women for Democracy and something like that. So I'm not saying I'm not going back home, but whether I'm in Addis Ababa, like those who went back, like I said, 2-3 months ago, or whether I'm here, the situation is the same.
When you talk about the Ethiopian national government in exile, who is behind that particular government? Does it have any particular support in Ethiopia? And does it, in fact, have any international recognition?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Ethiopian government in exile mission is not to become, for me or for those who are struggling with me, to become president or leader or to become government. We are the voice of the oppressed people, and we've been helping the political parties in Ethiopia. On their behalf, we have been also lobbying. And so basically, we are civil rights and human rights educator, you know. And it's not a government at the beginning, you know, was established as a government, and then we converted completely to political advocacy and a lobbying in Washington. And then, so nobody is behind the Ethiopian national government, or no foreign government is involved. It's just us Ethiopians. First, when I formed Ethiopian government in exile, formerly Ethiopian Women for Peace and Democracy Party in 1981 was to enlighten the Ethiopian people about the socialist government and the separatists that were sponsored to separate the country, such as the TPLF, OLF, and EPLF. So right. It has no any personal purpose. It's just to help the people, our people, to establish democratic government in Ethiopia and people constitution.
Thank you very much. Let me go to Milton. Milton, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Ndugu.
Thank you very much for your patience.
Oh, I'm very honored to be on your show, as always.
Now,
I think your show makes significant impact all over the African continent. So I'm honored, as always.
Profoundly honored, of course, for your compliments and support.
Thank you.
Now, let me ask you this question, Milton. When you talk mm-hmm. to people about African politics, people yes. are very quick to be very dismissive about the role of opposition political parties on the continent. Is it because political parties on the continent are ineffective, are weak, are not focused, or is it because they are having a problem of not having adequate or sufficient political space in which to operate?
Well, let me start with the tail end of the question. Political space within which to operate. That is the absolute answer, and it goes back to what my brother in the studio said, James, where politics is regarded as a zero-sum game. And it also goes to what you said, where politics is regarded as the politics of the belly. And these issues need to be addressed. Obviously, let's take the example of Uganda, where the National Resistance Movement regime of General Yoweri Museveni dominates absolutely the political space. As we saw in the 2016 election, when the EU observer team came to see that election and came out with a report, which, by the way, is posted online and advise not only governments but opposition parties, not only in Uganda but all over Africa, to look at the report, the final report of the EU team. And it analyzed that election. And it said the government absolutely dominated the media space, the financial space, where in fact there was no distinction between the state resources and the party resources. So you can't have an environment like that and expect independent political parties to grow and to be vibrant. And then obviously the next thing is the media space, because they go hand in hand. If you look carefully, you see that when entrenched regimes are crushing opposition parties, they're normally also crushing opposition or independent press. So for example, in Uganda, we have seen independent media, such as the Daily Monitor, their offices have been raided by the military when the government is dissatisfied with their coverage. So when people say the opposition are weak in African countries, there's a reason behind it. It is because in most cases, the state has absolute control and has hijacked all the political space, all the economic space, as well as the media space. So these are the issues that need to be addressed. And then, Chuck, I would like to add one more point. In terms of trying to balance and level the playing field, I think African countries should explore one option. And I know this is going to be very tough to implement, but at least we can start talking about it. When we are about to have presidential elections, the incumbent president should step down, and there should be a transitional interim president for the election period. So if the election period is 2 months, if it's 3 months, the incumbent should not be president, should not be exercising the powers of president. You could introduce a creative element, perhaps the Speaker of Parliament, perhaps the Chief Judge, but it has to be somebody different from the incumbent president. And what does this do, Shaka? This means if there's a dispute in the outcome of the election, it can be adjudicated independently. Because once you have the incumbent sitting there, even if the ruling is not in his favor, he is not going to yield power. And in fact, so long as he's sitting there as president, commanding the police forces, commanding the armed forces, it's much more likely that even if there's a legal challenge, the courts would rule in favor of the incumbent, because the judges fear the consequences. So those are my suggestions, Shaka.
Very interesting. But what about the recent case of Madagascar? You have a situation in Madagascar where an incumbent president has actually conceded defeat, saying that the people had spoken, and the two former presidents are actually going to a presidential runoff in 2 weeks' time.
That should be applauded. That should be commended. But that is the rare instance of when we see an example like that. Obviously, we welcome that, and we want that to become the trend in African countries. Ashaka, I don't want to sound like I'm a bit too pessimistic, because Uganda is not the only case in Africa. We saw in neighboring Kenya, where at one point there was a belief that we might see much more violence in Kenya after the outcome of the election were in dispute. But what did we see? Raila Odinga decided to set a good example for the rest of Africa. That even though many believed he won, and he certainly believed and knew that he won, for the sake of Kenya, Africa.
Why wouldn't you say Raila Odinga and President Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta? Because it takes two to tango.
It takes two to tango, absolutely. But in his case, his followers, the opposition followers, were in a very excitable mode. So his words and his decisions were very critical at that time. So I think he should be commended for what he did. It was a very statesmanlike conduct. And of course, Uhuru should also be commended for embracing him and creating a new environment in Kenya. And there are many examples that we can speak to in Africa.
Thank you very much. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We will have more of our discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known. It's Upfront every Wednesday, 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, and you can also watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the recent release of political prisoners in Rwanda. U.S. lawmakers are pressing Rwanda's government against incarcerating a dissident politician. Is this a sign of political tolerance? We'll discuss those issues on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today, we are discussing the role of opposition political parties in Africa. And our guests are Dr. James Ngundi, a political analyst and adjunct professor of languages in the African Studies program at Georgetown University, Yeharawa Gashau, Pan-Africanist activist and actress. She joins us live via Skype from Dallas, Texas, and Milton Arimadi, founder, publisher, and editor, Black Star Newsletter, who joins us from New York. Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, I have to say I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
It's a pleasure.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
You're most welcome, Yaharwak. Let me come to you immediately, James. You heard, of course, Milton make his case. You also heard earlier Yaharwak make her case. What is your reaction to what they talked about? When you listen to Milton, you listen to a man describing the lack, of course, of political space in as far as the opposition is concerned, which probably means we shouldn't, in fact, be calling some of those events elections, because they seem increasingly to be what some would characterize as selections. Would that be a fair assessment?
In a lot of cases, yes, it would be. But I would still call them elections. The fact that you have a process and the fact that the apparent winner is either not declared the winner or his victory is snatched from him or from her.
But you have a process in which, for example, an incumbent president who is democratically challenged is competing against people whose hands are tied behind their backs and their feet tied together, while he is very free to throw his punches.
Yes. All said, all correct. But the reality also is that even under such circumstances, we've seen opposition politicians do very well. And even though the victory is ultimately snatched from them, the challenge that they've posed, despite the difficulties.
But those are very, very few cases, James.
There are few cases, but it's a long journey. And one of the realities, and I think I alluded to this earlier, that we have to remain alive to, is the view of opposition politics and opposition parties on the continent generally. Most citizens, when they are polled or when they are asked for their opinions, most Africans do believe in having opposition parties. They like having opposition parties. They like having them compete. But the problem is, once the election is over, most of them would want to see them do a completely different role or play a completely different role. Now, traditionally, we look at opposition parties as having the primary role of keeping check the government of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But most citizens of African countries, when they are asked what opposition parties should do after elections, would tend to say they need to cooperate with the government of the day to bring development.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in itself puts opposition parties in a very tricky situation. Now, I will grant that because of the power that the incumbent political parties have, whether it's control of resources, whether it's control, as Milton alluded to, of the instruments of power. So we are talking about the police force and military or other security forces, the economy, using public funds to run, you know, party affairs and elections. Those are all, no question about it, those are, you know, dangerous. You know, it's a dangerous state of affairs, and it does not augur well for opposition politics. But at the same time, I think we are seeing political opposition, you know, parties making some progress. Now, it may not be as fast progress as we would want to see, but I think we cannot ignore the fact that opposition politics, as defined, as understood by the citizens of the African continent, may be slightly different from the traditional view of the role of opposition parties. And that might be something that we have to address if opposition parties are to start gaining ground in elections.
Why is it possible, for example, that opposition political parties function in the West, function in most of Asia, and in fact, interestingly, currently function very, very well in South America or Latin America, but not in Africa.
Some people,
and especially when it comes to East Africa, the Great Lakes region, Central Africa, and North Africa.
Well, I would really look at it as a continent-wide problem. It's true there are some, you know, some areas, some spots of light, of hope in some parts of the continent. But I think it's a continent-wide illness.
For the most part.
For the most part.
Is it cultural?
I think to an extent there is the element of culture cannot be dismissed. Remember, most African societies did rule through consensus. Now, this might be one of the legacies of colonialism, because if colonialism taught us anything, it taught us that having power was a good thing, and whoever had power made the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the colonial powers grabbed all the power, they made the decisions, and that element of consensus ruling or consensus leadership was eliminated. Now, come independence. Those who took over from the colonialists learned very well from the colonialists themselves. Yes. They realized that power was a good thing. And the idea of sharing power was not something that they looked at positively. And so when we see these political opposition political parties coming in, the question is, how do those in power look at them? They're not looking at them as partners.
Mm.
They're not looking at them as people presenting alternative points of view. So really, our political parties are not based on, say, policy ideologies. They are based on getting into office, getting into power, and retaining that power. Now, if we started looking at governorship, governance, rather than looking at leadership as ruling. Because I do believe in many countries on the African continent, we have not yet transitioned from rule to leadership.
Right.
We are still trapped in the idea of whoever gets into office becomes a ruler. Now, a ruler does not often like giving space because he rules or she rules. Whereas leadership, a leader will look at different, you know, aspects of the game, will listen to different points of view, will listen to, you know, that's what makes leadership. We lack that on the African continent.
What about the apparent definitions of what politics is or is not? Mm-hmm. Politics, on the one hand, can be characterized as the art of all possibilities. It can also be characterized as about who gets what, when, where, and why.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the definitions will depend on who is giving the definition. So we can be idealists and look at politics as the art of possibilities, and that is true on the one hand. On the other hand, it is also an opportunity to grab whatever you can. It's an opportunity to be absolute. Now, I'll go back to this idea of institutions, and I know this is a drum that has been beaten over and over, but I think one of the things that is still ailing our continent is the lack of institutions. We continue to have very weak institutions. So Milton, for example, was alluding to, you know, the elections. Whether you look at elections in Uganda or even in a country like Zimbabwe or Kenya, a lot of times you have an election where the institutions really are only there for the incumbent. And even when you have, in the case of Kenya, in the last election, the Supreme Court come back and annul the election and order for a new election, where are the institutions that are supposed to guarantee a fair election? In many of our countries, they are missing. And so as long as you have the lack of strong institutions, that can guarantee, that can put, check on the incumbent and on the government of the day, we are going to continue having these challenges. And I do think, while it, you know, I do see Milton's frustration with the president of the day campaigning to retain power and the effect that would have on resources and all the so likelihood of him winning are high. I'm not sure how, we would structure a case where the incumbent, steps down and we have an interim president. Now, that would be a very good, in an ideal world, kind of solution. The only challenge I see here is how do we get the interim government in power or in place to make sure that they can oversee the election, and how do we guarantee that interim government is not rooting for the same government that the incumbent, because they still control, a lot of power. So that becomes a challenge.
Can that happen, for example, before a vast majority of people are socially and politically aware, socially and politically conscious?
Yeah.
To such an extent that they happen to be aware of what their rights are, that they are indeed the masters, they are the ones who employ the president, they are the ones who employ the Supreme Court justice, they are the ones who employ the commander of the armed forces, the inspector general of police and what have you, that these people, in fact, are supposed to be servants of the people.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that concerns me, even as we talk of opposition politics right now, is that in many African countries, those who lead the opposition parties were at one time members of the ruling parties. So really, they just transitioned from the ruling parties to form their new parties.
Especially in your country of Kenya.
No question about it.
Almost everybody you can look at traces his political culture to Kanu.
Absolutely. And so that makes it very difficult for them to... But even in other countries, that still remains the case because we've had, you know, political parties ruling for decades. And so right now, the kind of generation of politicians that we have are really politicians that were schooled in one-party system. They are politicians that were schooled in a system that described governorship or winning an election, as I called it earlier, a zero-sum game. Until we get to a point where we have transitioned, where we have a better educated. And educated here is not referring to people with degrees. We are talking about a more politically conscious. Populace. People who can link those dots.
Where is civic education when we need it?
Where is civic education when we need it? Apparently, you know, we don't seem to put a lot of stock in civic education as we should. And I quite honestly believe that a lot of people are yet to make that connection, to connect those dots between what they do on election day and what happens at the dinner table in terms of food. A lot of people are still struggling in terms of, I vote, that's one part of my life.
Very interesting.
My life, my family, my finances, a different part of my life. But all these things are interconnected, and until we get that, a common knowledge to the population, we'll continue to have issues.
Very interesting. Yeherwak, are you there?
Yes.
What about servant leaders? Where are servant leaders in Africa? And when you look at your country, Ethiopia, I hope that I'm not wrong, but I would be tempted to suggest that Ethiopia probably has never at any one time in its history experienced a semblance of democracy. How do you expect to go towards a democratic dispensation, really?
That's a great question. We can't really make or change or bring democracy in Ethiopia from, the experience I have in Africa as well as in Ethiopia until you read my mind. Both of you read my mind. I was like saying like, oh, they just took my line. the key issue is to educate, to enlighten first the majority, the mass of the country. And otherwise, when you talk politics, people are scared, just like you said. We have never seen, we don't know what democracy is in Ethiopia, So when you talk about politics, or when you're trying to inform the people about their rights, they're scared. Just, even when they're talking, among two people, they're scared. They don't want to hear about politics. So they think politics is their enemy, and they're ashamed of it. And so to make a change, to bring democratic government in Ethiopia, we need to educate the people in every language that people can understand, including in Amharic.
I see. Milton, it is said that politicians, when it comes to running for office,
yes,
they do so in poetry.
Yes.
They promise heaven on earth. They tell people what they think they want to hear. Is it possible, really, to get servant leaders in Africa? Is it possible to get good governors, really? People who are there for the interests and concerns of the people? Because we're not talking about altruism here. without having a society, frankly, that is really adequately socially and politically conscious.
Okay, Shaka, but it can be built. Even the United States, where it is today, it had to start from somewhere. So, for example, the founding fathers were there, and then the parties that we see today in the United States actually drifted and then became apart. And that's how they ended up having multiple parties. They had to start from somewhere. So it's hard to imagine a situation where the consciousness precedes the democratic dispensation. They go hand in hand. And there has been some evolution in Africa. Let's look at some West African countries, for example. There are many examples in West Africa now. Ghana once was, you thought of Ghana a long time ago, it was military regimes. You thought of Nigeria years ago, it was military regimes. You thought Liberia, you thought Sierra Leone, chaos, bloodshed, but they've evolved. So I believe that people in Africa actually are becoming much more conscious and much more knowledgeable about their rights. And they know the better future that they have in Africa. So obviously we have to promote the good examples. In South Africa, Mandela could have been president until he passed on in his sleep, given the legacy and the esteem that he had. But he wanted to set an example for South Africa and for the continent. He served one term, and then he said, the young generation, you now carry the ball. Tanzania, for example, Tanzania now has many former presidents who are coexisting peacefully and setting an example for the next generation in Tanzania. But I go back to my homeland, Uganda. You can't have an environment where the president says publicly that I am not your servant. I'm here to serve my family. Anybody can go on YouTube and watch it. It's on TV. He said it publicly. I am not your servant. When in fact, he is the servant, and presidents are supposed to be the servant of the nation. So when you have an example like that, an entrenched regime in power for over 30 years, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And not only in a theoretical sense. In Uganda, we know how corrupt the government is. In fact, as I speak to you, there's a trial going on in federal court here in the United States where a Chinese businessman, Patrick Ho, allegedly paid Uganda's foreign minister $500,000 wire transfer, went to Uganda's swearing in 2016 of General Museveni and took $500,000 in cash. The verdict, in fact, might come out this afternoon or tomorrow in that case. We can't have those kind of examples in Africa. And then one other point I want to make. Brother James is correct in that some of these leaders have become like the colonial entities that we replaced in the 60s. So many of our opposition leaders, they're in fact fighting a new colonial power in Africa. It happens to be indigenous African governments. Look at Besigye, the way he's been treated. You showed some of the clips, being beaten, thrown like a goat in those pickup trucks. Can you imagine? And all he wants is to exercise his power of being able to contest and actually win an election and to be sworn in as president. We can't treat the opposition the way incumbents are treating them in Africa today. You showed us the image of Ugandan members of parliament being brutalized by security forces in parliament. How can the masses respect our institutions if we can send armed forces to the parliament to beat members of parliament? You saw what happened in Arua when those five members of parliament and their supporters brutally beaten. One actually is a former member of parliament, Bobby Wine and his colleagues, beaten brutally just because they dared compete for an opposition candidate who ended up winning a by-election. So we have many good examples in Africa, but we have many bad examples as well. We need to highlight the good ones, and we need to challenge and ultimately eliminate the bad examples.
You mentioned something about Tanzania. I know that you can be very sentimental when it comes to Tanzania because, after all, you spent some of the exile years in Dar es Salaam.
Yes, I did.
What about the incumbent president, John Pombe Magufuli? He doesn't seem to be democratic, does he?
No, he does not. But Tanzania has institutions that seem to be functioning. Tanzania has term limits. Kenya has term limits. Uganda does not have term limits. Uganda had age limits. And the reason why those members of parliament were beaten in September 2017 was because they were resisting the incumbent's attempt to remove term limits, which he did. So it's important to have institutions. So Magufuli himself may not be pro-democracy like Kikwete and his predecessors were, but at the end of the day, he's going to be bound by the institutions that Tanzania has. I don't imagine Tanzanians will allow him to remove term limits.
Thank you very much. By the way, there is a very, very important issue that I would like to talk about, and that is, of course, the passing away of H.W. Bush, the 41st president of the United States. May his soul rest in eternal peace. Yerowak, you come from a state, of course, where H.W. Bush came from. What do you think that President Bush would be best or most remembered for in as far as Africa is concerned?
Well, this is very difficult question about a person I know I met for the first time, you know, when I came to you.
What kind of person was he? How did he strike you?
Well, as an Ethiopian, I mean, you know, I have a different view, but I think he will be remembered as a hero, especially, you know, because he served his country in the Second World War, I believe. Mm-hmm. You know, beside that, I don't know, because, as I said, you know, I really don't know, because he signed for, you know, for suppression of Eritrea. He supported. So due to this issue, I have a problem.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What about you, James? Of course, you can talk about Operation Restore Hope in Somalia, which did not immediately restore hope, but he tried nonetheless.
He did try.
And also, you remember that apartheid South Africa ended on his watch.
Right.
And guess what? The United States negotiated for the fact that apartheid South Africa had nuclear capability. It negotiated that nuclear capability should not be handed over to the new authorities. Mm-hmm. Can you believe Africa could probably have now been a power of sorts?
Yes. I'm not sure whether that would be a good thing or a bad thing. In my world, I would rather have a world without nuclear weapons. So anytime we can secure nuclear weapons, I would be happy.
Thank you.
I would rather, I'm happy with his accomplishments as far as at least presiding over the waning days of apartheid in South Africa is concerned.
And he was a gentleman and an officer, especially the manner in which he treated the issue of the collapse of the Berlin Wall. He did not listen to his friends to go and dance there because he said that was an opportunity for the Germans to dance themselves. Right. Well, on that note, our guests today were Dr. James Ngundi, Yaharawak Gashau, and Milton Alimadi. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners.
Thank you.
For many of our Voices of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning is Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa, and please remember to keep the African hopes alive.